Welcome to Business Lives by Vox Markets, the podcast that brings you closer to the people who shape the world of business. We give you an insight into the lives of the individuals who stand out from the crowd. For updates on the latest episodes, please subscribe to our channel.
On the podcast today, we have Lara Morgan. She set up Pacific Direct in 1991, and it all began when she trotted off to the Dorchester in borrowed clothes and a bag full of shower caps, soaps and shampoos to secure her first sale. The company grew and grew and traded in 110 countries worldwide, and Lara sold 99% of her shares in 2008, pre-financial crash, for over £20 million. Since then, she's invested in many startups. She's also finished 10th in the Beijing World Triathlon Series, and she's appeared on The Apprentice, You're Fired, judging panel.
You know, the night I sold the business, I was on my own. I was at Alls Wang in a legal office. There were about 24 lawyers. It took 3 hours and 48 minutes to sign the paperwork. I left the building at about 1:40 in the morning. There's nobody on the street. It's Chancery. It's Holborn. And my family were skiing, so they were fast asleep. And, you know, that's 10 years ago. But there are things that you remember, and that is one of the most odd. You sold your baby. And you can't celebrate.
Laura, it's great to have you here in the studio. Would you like to start by telling the listeners a little bit more about yourself?
50-year-old woman, 3 children, happily married, still striving in the enterprise space. I set up a business when I was 23, having traded very well at school. My traded cigarettes through duty-free. Ended up selling soap to hotels. No plan, no clue. 9 years later, got a plan, went to a course called the Business Growth Development Program. Literally life-changing. I learned at that stage I was running the 57th fastest-growing company in Britain independently, and I learned actually that I wasn't as shit as I thought I was. So I got a plan, wrote a plan, stuck to the plan, and we went from sort of, I'd say, chaotically, disjointedly making progress to a much more structured way of doing things with some business education. And
what you're talking about there is Pacific Direct.
Yeah, I am. And a soap selling company to hotels. So everybody that nicks and takes stuff home was who I backed. And we exited that business 10 years ago, having sold branded luxury toiletries in 110 countries around the world, representing brands like Bulgari and Penhaligon's, and having the most extraordinary journey with factories in China and the Czech Republic, a joint venture in Egypt, and quite a lot of laughs.
Amazing. There's a few things that I'm going to dive into there, but I wanted to know a little bit about what, before you started that company, did you have entrepreneurial parents? Where did that spark come from? Why did you turn up at the Dorchester?
I think hunger is quite a good driver. So I left school at 18. I was sent to a private school. It was fantastic. I played a lot of sports and I managed to do some academic stuff, but it wasn't that important. I wanted to go to Loughborough to do sports science, and my dad went bankrupt. So I got a job in Hong Kong, which is where we lived. So I'd always been surrounded, I guess, by a sort of enterprising and hardworking society, which I grew up in. But got a job selling promotional giveaway items at the age 18 because I wanted to be a golf pro. I was a pretty good golfer in those days. And that went wrong because I started making commission and having quite a good social life, and that's not good for your handicap. So I kept selling promotional giveaways. And then at the age of 23, I ended up in UK. And there were no jobs in 1991, which seems like yesterday to me on some days and a long time ago at other times, because in between, I sold promotional giveaways and items in Hong Kong. I ran a Yellow Pages advertising team in the Middle East, which isn't sort of an average career. And then I worked in the in New Zealand. And then I ended up in England building a one-man band with no plan and no clue. And I just sort of started reading books from W.H. Smith in the business section to find out sort of what was the next missing piece of my puzzle. It was a very large puzzle and a lot of missing pieces. So it went from there.
And how did that initially start?
In those days, no word of a lie. And there's probably people listening who don't even can't comprehend this. But I would spend Sundays in the Bedford Library with the Yellow Pages, and I would write down the hotel phone numbers because you weren't allowed to photocopy the book. In fact, the library didn't have a photocopier. And then I would go and call those hotels. So I still have an encyclopedic knowledge of phone numbers in London. And my first customer was the Dorchester. That was my grandmother's strategic advice. And I was very lucky. I met someone who basically spotted that I was an idiot. And Ken Roberts said to me, you know, I like your pre-threaded sewing kit. And I didn't know anything about pre-threaded sewing kits, but it was the product that I had to sell. And I had shower caps, and that was it. So he said, look, I, you know, quote me 10,000. And I thought, frankly, I thought I'd made it. And then I walked down Park Lane thinking, actually, if they're only about 20p, that's not a very big order and that's not going to pay the bills, but it's a start. And actually, the real gem was grandmother's strategic advice, which is if you start in a business and you can get a name-dropping, you know, company, you can open every door. And you can imagine that, you know, when you then are calling up other hotels and you're saying, you know, I'm a factory representative from China, they laugh you out of town. But if you then go and I'm supplying the Dorchester, then they listen.
So that all sounds like it went to absolute plan.
Yeah, there was no plan. I mean, you know, I you make your luck, because I was brave enough to turn up to the Dorchester with borrowed clothes at the age of 23, and I'd never been really to London above ground before. And I remember shaking. I still remember the day. And, you know, I just went in and I talked openly and honestly to learn. And I think this was a really big thing, which is I knew nothing and I always felt I had stuff to learn. So I said to Ken Roberts, who was a procurement guy, I said, you know, I want to understand how you decide to make the choices around what our industry was called, which is hotel amenities. And I was very lucky. I met someone who was extremely helpful, and then I lied to him because I had to wing it. Because as I was leaving, he said, you know, when we buy 10,000, we only call them off every month and we want you to deliver them next day, and they need to be branded in a Pantone number 928 burgundy. And I remember going, yes, that's all fine. And those sewing kits, about 9,000 of them, lived sort of under my fax machine and around my desk. And because I didn't have a warehouse and I'd never cleared goods, I'd never imported, I'd, you know, I just traded giveaways before. So I figured I could do it.
So from a one-man band, how did you scale up that company? How did you make the company bigger? You've talked about your first sales, but what about your first member of staff?
2 years in, I got a bit bored of being sort of the bog cleaner and the post girl and the salesperson and the chief executive by default, because I arrived first, which was a miracle. In fact, I spent the rest of my career working out who else should be the CEO, because I didn't think I never knew what I was doing. And the answer is that I employed a girl off the hockey pitch who was nearly as bossy as I was, because I thought she could sell. And it was madness, because we could already sell. What we were rubbish at is admin, but I thought admin was boring, so I just did it on Saturdays and Sundays. And the business went from 108,000 in its first year in 91. It did 360. Two one-man band did 360K in our second year. And then we did 880 in our third year, and we were off to the races with two of us.
Fantastic. And you said that those first two years of Pacific were, I've quoted, the loneliest of your life. Is that
true? I think so. I mean, you know, I used to bribe myself that if I had a good day calling and selling, then I could go into what was the butty shop at Cranfield University, where my other half was doing an MBA, and actually be with people at lunchtime. But it was almost like it was a punishment that if I didn't have enough good sales calls or good sales leads. And there were days when I was sort of keeping a cricket score and I was making 100 calls and barely speaking to anybody, but always leaving a message, always being polite, always trying to be engaging, always trying to be memorable. And I think in the end, that sort of 23-year-old, you don't know what you don't know, but polite persistence and, you know, being honest. You know, people would say to me, well, you know, our sewing kits are made in Kent. And I'll go, actually, I think you'll find they're made in China. And perhaps I can come and talk to you about that, because, you know, I was re-educating the market and doing things differently. But yeah, it was brutally lonely, but I was creative and I was doing lots of different jobs, and I drove 77,000 miles in 1 year, so that kept me out of trouble.
Fantastic. So what basic skills do you believe that somebody needs? You've talked about your drive and persistence. Is that the only thing that somebody needs to set up a business?
No, I think the skill set's very broad, but no question about the importance of resilience, which I wish we sort of had a magic tablet, because you know, it's painful, you get turned down, you have to bounce back up. But I think all of those childhood experiences, getting back on the horse or the bicycle or whatever it is, they matter. having good parenting in my case. You know, if at first you don't succeed, try again. Look after the pennies and the pounds look after themselves. I can bore you witless with, you know, that status of upbringing, but it works. And I think the other skills that you have to have is you sort of, well, there's no question that you have to teach yourself finance. So, or if you know it, fantastic. But I literally had one of those magnificent red ledgers and did bought and sales ledgers and sharpened my pencils and fill in the boxes, which I'm rubbish at doing. If there was any class at school, luckily, it's maths that I liked, but, you know, it's dull filling in boxes. So what I knew is that if I could learn how the money worked through the business, and I had a very small amount, £17,000 approximately to start with, then I could milk that money by turning it really quickly. And all I ever did is I placed, you know, I raced the turn of the money and I made good profit decisions, and I literally would reinvest every penny. And then we got to the stage about, I don't know, 3-4 years in where we were growing. You know, we went from 360 to 880K in a year. And first of all, the bank said I couldn't do it. And then the bank wouldn't give me an overdraft, so I moved banks. And, you know, it was difficult. You weren't going to get funding. So I started factoring and people would gulp and go, oh my God, that's so expensive. But I had such good margin control that the choice was don't grow fast and you're still making money, but you just won't make as much, or factor and lose 6% of the margin of the stuff that you factor. Well, so what at that point? We were doing extremely good innovational things. So I think also innovation matters, and, you know, open-mindedness, the skill set is vast, but at the heart of it, and when you then start recruiting people, I think, you know, the ability to realize that you don't know all the answers, two ears, one mouth, you know, listen to the brilliance around you, employ really good people. I employed a brilliant lady also from the hockey club who was a town planner, but she became my operations director, and without Margaret, I was toast. In the same way that Rachel was my first salesperson, and, you know, she was a young woman who I sent to the Czech Republic and said, go and sell to the 5-star hotels, and she cried on her first night, but she's never looked back. And, you know, it's about working with people and giving people chances and having a laugh and being flexible and being agile. And because I didn't know tradition of work, you know, we literally worked out of my granny flat and we bought donuts on good days and did simple stuff, but it worked.
And you talk about, well, the Pacific Direct obviously turned into a global company. You were in 110 different companies. What advice would you have for somebody that's looking to take their company abroad and looking to expand into overseas territories?
So trading in 110 countries requires currency knowledge, shipping and freight, but that's a lesson, and there's a shipping language, and that just is a learning journey. And then I think, you know, there's a lot of rubbish talked about complexity. In my case, I was very lucky. I'm not selling, you know, whacking great diggers or something you can't put in your suitcase. I'm selling bars of soaps and sewing kits, for goodness sake. So you can, you know, pack it into a bag, arrive in a country. In my case, we learned some really good, you know, secrets, like asking the taxi driver what's the latest best 5-star hotel to open, what's the best hotel being built at the moment, you know, understanding the market. I used to hire a taxi late at night and then get the taxi to drop off my samples at all the different places I intended to visit but hadn't got appointments with, and then go to the appointments, call people in between, duck and dive, work my art backside off.
Yeah, you can swear, it's fine.
And yeah, I mean, it was hard work. I mean, you know, you try doing that at 35 degrees in Dubai, but actually you're motivated because you've got to pay the bills and you've taken the chance of employing people and you have to pay their salaries. So I was very motivated first and foremost by the responsibility I had for people and by the paranoia of failure, I think.
So your business must have taken you all over the world.
Yeah, I mean, 84 of the countries we traded in, I got to go to. Fantastic. You know, which was, you know, and that's huge, right? So go and see the pyramids at 4 a.m. before you have an appointment with Four Seasons in Cairo. That's pretty cool.
So setting up in 1991, turning around in 2008 and selling.
Yeah.
Was that always on the cards to sell the company? How was exiting the company? And why did you decide to exit at that point? A great point by the sounds of it in 2008.
Yeah, I mean, luck. Again, the timing was ridiculous. I sold on the 2nd of April and the world went, frankly, tits up not long after, particularly the hotel world and the luxury sector that I was in. But ultimately, I felt that I wanted to change the role I was in and not be doing quite as much travel. I had 3 small children under the age of 9. actually even younger than that. I think 7, 5, and 3 or something.
But this must have been your baby as well.
Yeah, you're selling your baby, be under no illusions. And it's your first baby, not in my case, because I'd had the business for 17 years. And we had, you know, 17 languages in the company. We had friends of the business who were partners and associates, and I think 476 members of the team around the world. I don't speak 17 languages, that's for sure, but I definitely had relationships with an awful lot of those people that I care about and are still friends today. But, you know, the selling of the business thing is I think, I bore the responsibility of being the income earner in our house, and I was riding the lottery, and I got quite tired, so I wanted to sort of change my life. And I had every intention of staying at Pacific, which was delusional and stupid, because I think that's a very difficult thing for the founder to do. And I lasted not very long.
So now that you've exited, what are you looking to do now?
So I've had a really interesting 10 years, and it is a roller coaster, and I don't ask for sympathy because I got a shitload of money in the bank. But I've been investing in British invention, and I've also been involved in Startup Britain. I've been, if you like, paying back my debt to society, which is kind of made up in my head, but I think you put back into life what you take out. So I've done Startup Britain for that reason. I've built Company Shortcuts, which is a brilliant training system for sales education, which Nicola Cook now runs. I've had the honor of working with Alistair Callender, who has the best travel cabin size, brilliant product invented because of a necessity. And I think if you invest in necessity, Gate 8 Luggage is one perfect example of a guy who used to run data centers at Sky. And he was fed up with checking in his bags and standing and watching the merry-go-round. So he solved the problem. And we never check in anymore. We've just got our bags and there's a zip off. And that's brilliant. That's life-changing if you travel short haul. And
so when you're looking to invest in somebody, are you investing in their product? Are you investing in
them
the person?
First? Without any question, them first. But I'm a product girl, so I'm not a tech investor. I like to touch and feel and see the product. I like to feel I can add value, which isn't always the case. And I'm really, really proud of some of the brilliant work that some of my entrepreneurs are doing. It's not always perfect. It's been, of course, a journey because we're all different. And, of course, I would like, you know, everybody to have the approach to business that I thought was right and it worked for me, but it isn't always right for them. And I'm learning to deal with different characters with different levels of ambition and different sales drive and, you know, a different ability to make sacrifices. Because, you know, to become wealthy out of enterprise, there's a very slim level that do it without serious graft. And I think there's a lot of people that can't take the graft.
So if you were the young girl going back to the initial Dorchester and you had somebody overlooking your shoulder like you are to many as an investor, what would you want them to be giving you in terms of advice, and what would you want them to look in and find from yourself?
I think, you know, it's often talked about now, and I got away with murder because I didn't really have a purpose other than paying the bills, you know, and eating. But I do think as you evolve, I mean, I learned the lesson, you know, we were making £674,000 EBITDA after 9 years, but we made £3.3 million EBITDA 8 years later. So in between, the only thing that changed is I wrote a very good business plan and we really got focused. I read a book called The Power of Focus. I've read Jim Collins' Good to Great. Mm-hmm. I've read it all. And I do continue to read business books because I think if I was learning again and talking to someone starting again, I think the relentless importance of having a passion to learn about business so that you lead well. I mean, I was I was there by default. So I think my self-consciousness was always driving me to be a better leader, to be fair, to be consistent. And those things have paid dividends because I do, and hopefully without arrogance and not lacking humility, believe that I can phone 99.9% of everybody I've ever worked with and say, do you want to come and work with me again? Because we've had a laugh and we don't, you know, I think staying fit and healthy matters to that person. And I think that you've got to know your numbers. So I think those, you know, treating the people right, knowing your finance, and having a plan with a purpose were the things that I would share.
I think when you say just staying fit and healthy, I think it just shows how much of a humble person you are, because really, staying fit and healthy is a massive understatement. I heard that you're
bit of a triathlete as well.
Yeah, I got lucky. When I sold Pacific, I took a bet with Martin Dawes from Coffee Nation that we would both enter the London Triathlon, and he didn't turn up, but I came third. So I did that for a year, and then I did quite well in the World Championships.
But, and what number was that?
10th, I think. Okay. If I'm absolutely right. I am proud as punch of that. It's pathetic, isn't it, that this 50-year-old git still gets... Yeah, no, I only did... It was my fifth triathlon. But really, I think that... It's like anything, isn't it? I had always felt that I wanted to do something competitive and well, and I stopped playing golf because of the, you know, other things in life. And I'm going to play golf when I'm 90, and I'm going to represent Britain. I'm going to be really good. But, you know, at the moment, I cycle a lot, and I think you have to have breaks from business. I have a brilliant brand called Centered. .me spelt with an S, so it's, you know, when you breathe in you feel centered, but if you add S it's about the scent. So those aromatherapy products are changing people's lives because they're giving them a habit tool which makes them stop, inhale and reset. And with the madness of digital and the enormity of I'm delighted to say people starting to think more seriously about looking after their mental well-being and their health, I think there's an awful lot that we can do to make the work and life balance better. And I don't talk about that lightly because I don't think you can balance it. I just think it's worth the fight to try and get close. You know, it's never perfect. On the day when I'm feeling, for want of a better description, fit and well, my children don't know my name and my bank account's empty. On the days when my bank account's doing well and I'm working my arse off and my children know my name, I might be a fat lass, you know, and I laugh. But I mean, actually, you know, it is difficult to get the balance. And I think that...
I've heard you say in the past that there's no such thing as work-life balance.
No, there isn't. I mean, you know, but you can fight to try. And in doing that, you know, you've got a better chance of being good at lots of things and your children remembering your name and making sure you don't miss nativity plays because you get your act together. But also, you've got to look after your own economic engine, and your economic engine is both your physical engine and your mental engine. And I know that if I have a bad day, an awful lot goes away when I go on a bike ride or I go, you know, I do something. And I think that is just the relentlessness of the way I am.
You seem the type of person that does 110% into everything that you do.
No, I don't. Of course I do my best. I mean, I was brought up that, you know, if you put into life, you get out. And I've lived by that. And I'm trying to teach my children that. And I'm trying hard to demonstrate that there's an, you know, what a choice at the age of 40 to be able to choose to do what you like for the rest of your life, which is really the big goal for me, was freedom, you know, choice. That's a hell of an honor. And then to work with good brands. And I'm proud as punch of that.
Did you ever think you'd be in the position where you were when you were that young girl at... How old were you when you were walking around?
I mean, I didn't even have an aspiration to run a business. I literally had an aspiration to pay my bills, eat, sleep, pay the rent. I mean, I was a good salesperson. Don't get me wrong. I'm passionate about the professionalism of sales. I still read books about learning to sell, and I think there's still stuff we can gain. But I've now got this huge opportunity to back products and propositions that really improve sustainability, and I now understand why, you know, flipping gray-haired as I am, entrepreneurs start thinking more about legacy and sustainability and philanthropy and the things that matter to them, because I've got time to make the choices and I've got time to make a difference. And truthfully, if you're making any example, you might as well make it to your own children, because you want to leave a good legacy.
So did that element of reflection come after you sold Pacific?
No, I definitely know that I sort of was doing deals with myself all the way along, because I was making sacrifices, and be under no illusions, you know, I didn't make it to every single sports day.
And is that something that you regret?
I don't regret anything. You know, I made a choice. So if I've made the choice, then I can't look back and regret it. I don't believe in regret. But what I do believe in is a balanced or a weighted approach. So for the choices that I made... And I tried to, you know, be fair. Do I think the outcome has far outshone the not making that choice? Then I do. You know, I got payback, and I can't believe I escaped without anybody finding out what a buffoon I am. But I think there's a lot of us that like the learning journey of enterprise. And here I am, the addict in investing in Kitbricks, which is, you know, a time-saving organizer bag system, because I want more time outdoors. And actually, I want more people to enjoy well-being and time outdoors. But I also probably do it because I know that they work hard, play hard, and I like those people.
So, a question that we ask all of our guests. If you had £10,000 in your pocket and you're 25 years old, what would you be doing? It's a very tough one, I know.
It's really tough.
I can see your face. It's just... It's
ironic because, you know, at the age of 23, I had my own savings of £17,000 to start Pacific Direct with. So, you know, if it had been then and somebody gave me £10,000, I would have been like,
wow,
sell more goods, but probably would have gone down the pub. what would I have done? I mean,
it's interesting you don't say the same as what you have done.
Yeah, I think it changes on your age. I mean, the £10,000 is a lot of money. And I remember, you know, looking back and thinking about the value of what I got about writing a business plan and going and doing the business growth development program, which was priced at around that. And it's priceless. It's changed my life because it really made me understand business and education and marketing and recruitment and all sorts of stuff that I just fluffed. If I had £10,000 at 25, I'd probably buy a car.
Well, it's interesting that you said education as well. That you want to educate to go forward and use that money to better develop your life. And that is interesting. A lot of people do say that they would do that or they would invest in a particular thing. So I guess your answer, if I could sum it up, would be education.
Yeah, everybody in our team has to grow, right? My children have to grow. I'm taking one of my only spoiled 14-year-old, but it's the only one I've got, to Uganda to have a miserable time, in the sense that, you know, she should be educated about how bloody lucky she is. I want to keep my kids grounded. And my two older daughters, they serve in the local pubs because they've got to make their own money in life, because the education of knowing what it is to earn your own money and saving it and then making choices about how you spend it, I think those are parental lessons that are, frankly, priceless. I'm not big on academic education in the sense of too much academia, because I think life teaches you a great deal. And, you know, I never went to university and it's gone quite well.
So, Laura Morgan, thank you very much for coming on the podcast today. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Nice to meet you.
For updates on the latest episodes, please subscribe to our channel.